Christian greetings in Jesus' worthy name. I was so blessed with the service thus far. I guess having read the story of the Gadarene demoniac many times already in my short life, I was blessed with the thoughts that our brother shared this morning. The singing of the hymns this morning, the Sunday school lesson, and the way it was presented and all, God has certainly spoken to my heart already. And yet, we look to the Lord once again for a message this morning. And I just, again and again, in ministry and in our lives throughout the years, there are two subjects that I really care about. There's a lot more subjects that I care about. I want you to understand that. And some other areas that are of tremendous importance. But I still think a lot about home life and church life. Children and youth around the world, if they were truly honest, want a home of order, love, and peace. And families around the world, if they have a heart for godliness and biblical practice, want a church life where love and peace are present. And yet, I ask myself the question, why is it that so many homes, even in plain circles, are lacking so desperately in the foundational elements that a Christian home should have very present? Did you ever think about that? Why is it that there are so many horror stories that come out of what is so-called a Christian home? That question boggles my mind again and again. The things that make a Christian home sometimes are desperately lacking. And it's a burden on my heart this morning. Because sometimes, in counseling with a young person, or reading a book, or hearing things that have happened, a person finds out that maybe it can sound right in Sunday school class, and maybe it can sound right whenever we give a topic on a Wednesday evening, or maybe it can sound right when it's coming from behind the pulpit, but then the youth, as they get older, somehow have a different story about how it was at home, and that just burdens my heart again and again. When in reality, at the end of the day, good home life and healthy church life become the fundamental structure from the which future homes and churches will one day come. But what if a Christian home does not live up to its name, and then on top of that, church life is chaotic? What is the future? What will the future be? What will happen to the rising generation? I know that sometimes there are those who go astray. I know that there is that carnal nature within us and the type of temptations and idolatry that we were talking about this morning in Sunday school. I know that those things are around, and I know not every person, even though they were raised in ideal situations, not every situation is a success story. I understand that. But is there anything we can do about this whole thing? The title this morning is simply this. It's a little question. How are things going at home? I tremble to speak on this subject because at our home, we have a lot of room to grow and improve. And I preach to myself, On Friday night, I spoke of church life, and there again, we still need to grow in our home congregation. But I shared a little bit of my burden that I carry for the body of Christ, not only locally, but other places. Let us remember today, my friends, that if the devil can destroy a home and then can destroy many homes, he eventually succeeds in destroying and consequently controlling an entire society. And America is good proof of that. And if he destroys a church and gets them to lose their testimony, then the light becomes darkness, the salt loses its savor, and things in the world degenerate at a yet faster rate. And evangelistic testimony becomes nil. But we as God's people, regardless of what our address is, or where we're placed geographically, need to take the challenge and be what God wants us to be, and lift a lantern of righteousness in a dark world, in our homes, and in our congregations, so that more children, youth, and families can be saved in this twilight of time. I call it twilight because the darkness is getting very, very intense and very close to all of us. By the same token that I've said all that I've said, every one of us come from some type of home, and we all have perspectives of how that was. But we have this morning the potential to provide safe, loving, and godly homes for the rising generation. And this message this morning, I trust, not only speaks to parents, myself included for sure. I hope it is an inspiration to youth who dream of possibly one day having their own home. And I trust it can even be an inspiration to grandparents, because grandparents need to continue holding forth the torch of faith and being by life an example, by word an example, by teaching an example. That whole thing we talked about last night of the older women teaching the younger women, and that can include grandmas. And grandpas passing on the torch of faith and giving encouragement to the youth among us and giving helpful words of encouragement and sometimes direction to young dads as they wonder if there's an end to the rat race of life. Sometimes an elderly grandpa can come around and just say, you know, brother, I saw what was happening this morning in church, and Little junior there, one of these days it'll come around. Just be a word of encouragement to them. And then somewhere in that whole package, this whole thing of prayer life and praying for the church and for the youth and for the children and the grandchildren. And not only the ones that darken the doors, but also the ones that are still outside. Those who have never yet heard the gospel. If we could only get a vision of that. And I believe you have it here. I've sensed that. I'm just preaching a little bit from my heart, I guess. So with that in mind, I want to look at just a few scriptures. I want to look at Colossians chapter 3. I'm sure you figured I was going to go here just to start. While you're looking for that, I might just tell a little story. This probably happened in an evangelical setting, but it happened probably near 100 years ago, maybe not quite, but it happened a while back. There was an evangelist that was traveling after a week of meetings, and he was traveling back home on a given Monday morning. And because the roads were not ideal to travel on, and because of the fact that he didn't have a four-wheel drive pickup truck, he was just driving in a common vehicle car. And because of the fact that overnight it had rained, he was driving down this muddy country road, and somehow or another he got stuck. And I want us to remember at least this one thing, that once in a while, God has something happen in our lives by divine appointment. And this happened to be one of those cases. His car got stuck, and he could not get out anywhere. It was all muddy around him. He got out of his vehicle, and he saw a light. It was kind of early in the morning because he was heading back home early. And he saw across the field a light in a house. And so he heads that direction, across whatever fences or fields or pastures. He got there to this house, and he heard a baby crying inside. And he knocked on the door. Nobody came to the door. He waited a bit and knocked on the door again. And after a while, a child came and opened the door. He got into the house. He said, come in, yeah. Somebody's muttered something, come in, yeah. And the man noticed something's wrong here. Something's wrong here. He saw a father taking care of a newborn, which is strange. He's trying to get this baby quiet. He noticed children that looks like mama wasn't around. He said, I see you're taking care of the baby. Where is the baby's mama? He said, the baby's mama we buried yesterday. He said, the evangelist said, was she a Christian? Yes, she was. The second question was, sir, are you a Christian? He said, no, I'm not. But I wish I was. The first step in having a Christian home is having parents that love Jesus more than anything else and have given their hearts to serve the Lord. That is the reason the evangelist got stuck out there in the mud. That's the reason. He had the privilege of leading that man to the Lord that day. Because daddy needed to be saved just like mama was. And they buried her the day before. And that gives a lot of grace in times of need, my friends. Just knowing where Jesus is and where I am in times of need. You're in Colossians chapter 3, verse 18. I'm just going to jump in here where it says what it does. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. Wives, submit unto your own husbands, not to somebody else's, but to your own husbands, as it is fit in the Lord. Respect dad when he's not at home. Think about when daddy's not at home, what daddy would do if he were here. Think about it. Because I know many of you, your husband's away at work. He's away possibly doing something, kingdom work or otherwise. But just think about it. And as you submit to your husband, it is similar to submitting to the Lord. And I know this has its context even where there's an unbelieving husband. And I am amazed to see how some women have carried a torch of faith somewhat alone, in spite of the fact that their husband was not a believer. But somehow God has answers for those situations, and I'm not going to go deep into any of these thoughts, but just the idea. Husbands, love your wives, and be not bitter against them. Those are two simple phrases. But they carry so much weight. Husbands, love your wives. And don't be bitter with them. Watch your words. Be careful how you talk to them and about them. Children, obey your parents in all things. It works better that way. Children at a young age find out if their parents are the kind of parents that they ought to be. What happens if they do not obey? At least they ought to know something about what happens then. When children obey their parents in all things, it is well-pleasing to the Lord. And if you spoke the Spanish language, you would see written in verse 21 a word that applies not only to daddies but also to mamas, talking about parents. It says, "Parents, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged." One day, I, as a young man, I was not married yet, was out passing out, unfortunately, la verdad, in a town in Costa Rica. And I came to this house, and I heard this yelling and this screaming, not only of a lady, but also of two children. I got closer to the house and I saw a woman dressed extremely immodestly. And she had a belt probably the length of what I have on me right now and maybe even longer. And she was whipping this belt in all directions with two children that were running around with not much on either. And the yelling and the screaming and the lashing of whip and whatever you could imagine. These children trying to run away from mom. And yet, I suspect that because of her appearance in that moment, I would suspect that those dear children were products of a sensual lifestyle. And she would much prefer not to have them around, but had to deal with them anyhow, because daddy, who was responsible, was probably off playing football, or if he was had any connection with her at all, is probably something very superficial at best, and no true love for her, and much less for the children. And there she was trying to deal with this. What she was trying to do was trying to get them a bath in a cold shower. If you know what that would be like, do children enjoy baths to begin with? Some do. But they don't enjoy standing under a cold shower, and she was trying to rein these children in with this kind of anger. And that vision comes back to my mind again and again. And yet, I know that if I would have walked up to that house at that moment, the flirty, gushy words that she would have tried to use and her appearance as it was would have been very, very seductive at the same time. Somehow, my friends, the connection between immorality and anger is awfully close. But the connection between anger and murder isn't much different either. The Bible teaches us that. And you wonder why the movies of our generation are filled with sexual improperness and violence. It comes right here. And sometimes in abusive situations, it gets pretty close to those who call themselves Christian. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, fathers or mothers. Why? Lest they be discouraged. In Spanish it says, para que no se desalientan, so it does not take the wind out of them. Have you ever seen a young person who is so beat down and so discouraged, they don't know what to do? They don't know what to do. They believe no one in the creation will understand them. And they're discouraged. And sin is so tempting in those times. There's a passage that's ringing in my ears these days, and I hope to preach on it at some point in the future. I wanted to add this morning that if you're a school teacher here today, maybe there's some words that would apply to you as you relate to children and youth. And this is one of them. And so if you're a parent, a grandparent, a teacher, employer, I just like this verse just is again and again going through my mind. I just need to read it in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 2. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 2. It's talking about a high priest. A high priest. It says here, who can have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are turned out of the way, for that he himself is also compassed with infirmity. You know very well that the first grader coming into your classroom has a lot of ignorance, okay? You know that the 10th grader sitting in your class has a lot of ignorance, and anyone in between. You know that the new employee that just brought his lunchbox to the job for the first time has a lot of ignorance. And by the way, the little one that the sisters are holding back there, or the brethren, whoever they are, whether they're a few days old or a few years old, there's an awful lot of ignorance there. They have a lot to learn from the time they're day one till the time they're 21, okay? And how do we convey to them the information, the knowledge that they need that will help them little by little, inch by inch, by the yard it is hard, by the inch, but what a cinch. And you just get, and line upon line, precept upon precept, get them from day one to 21. How does that happen? Some days we just need to have some downright compassion on those that don't know. And on them that are turned out of the way. Because some days, it seems like, well, it happens a lot with a given age of adolescence. One day they're a man, and the next 2 days they're a boy. One day or two, they're just seeming, wow, where did this little young lady come from? The next day, well, she's just a little girl yet. And parents face that. And sometimes we wonder if we're gaining or losing. But this is a principle to keep in mind. How does Jesus relate to us? Is there anything we're ignorant of? If you're a teacher today, if you're a parent or a grandparent or a preacher or an employer, maybe you could think about that a while. I want to go now to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew 18, in the context that I'm going to read today, became very, very special to me whenever a neighbor lady who we had been visiting, a neighbor lady there in Costa Rica where we lived, she attended Bible studies and she wanted to learn about Jesus in some small way. But she had a very sad experience in her life. She had a young child, newborn, he's like 6 months old, and one day he got a fever. And the fever not only stayed at 100, it went to 101 and then 102. And then 103, and then 104. And she saw that this was getting out of control, because when it gets to 104, you've got problems because there's potential brain damage on its way. And she called an ambulance to come, and the ambulance said, we're busy right now, and they live way back in the mountains. There was no way they could really get there fast anyhow, and they were kind of slow about it, and so on. And the fever hit 105, and I'm not even sure where it quit. But truth be told, that child, as far as I know, was permanently brain damaged from that day and forward. And she, in her limited knowledge of biblical understanding, in her limited way, I heard her pray one time. It was a very, very interesting prayer. How she tried to express herself to God. I heard it. And she went out to the capilla or whatever, the chapel in the hospital, and she just got down on the floor and said, God, if you'll let my son live till 1 year old, I'm going to have a little birthday party for him. I'm going to invite some friends, and I'm going to have those Mennonites come over and share a little something from God's word and have a little singing. Because of the situation as it was, I was asked to speak there at the birthday party of a 1-year-old brain-damaged boy. And her mom and her dad. I mean, his mom and his dad, it was a little boy, I'm sorry. His mom and his dad sitting there, they weren't married. There's a lot of life that they never learned about Bible principles, and we tried to talk to them about it. We were good friends with them. And I went to Matthew 18, and I spoke to a group of people about a quarter of the size of this right here. About a quarter of this size, and people that never darkened the door of our church. And whenever I think of Matthew 18, my mind goes back to that little time. At the same time, Matthew 18, verse 1, came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them. 18:3, and said, "Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. But whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if thy eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life with one eye, rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire. Take heed. Take heed, Jesus says. Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of their Father which is in heaven. For the Son of Man is come to save that which was lost. How think ye? If a man have 100 sheep, and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seeketh the one that is gone astray? And if so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish." And that evening, being able to preach to people that were maybe good Catholics and maybe no religion whatsoever is an experience that I probably will never forget. But I tried to speak frankly the teachings of Jesus that night. Take me out of that illustration, but just take it as a little story to a personal experience. Do you see anything there? Let's think first of all about childlike faith. I'm going to tell you something, mamas and daddies, even grandparents. If you find that the hospital bill is too big, if you find that the search that you're on right now, the issue that's facing your family, the health problem that is beyond your control, if you find that you don't have the faith to see it yourself through it, do you know one thing that you can do? Is you can get the youngest child in your family to start praying about it. You know, you teach your children, if you're a godly mom and dad, that my God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. And somehow or another, as we get older and we begin to calculate checkbook balances and credit cards against what we're facing, it looks impossible to us. But they see Dad and Mom doing stuff they could never do, time after time after time, and they believe all God is what, something way bigger than Dad and Mom. And if they could, Dad can grab a big wheelbarrow full of rocks and he can push it and move it and dump it over there. They could never do that, but they can pray because they believe it, because God's big and strong and mighty. He's way bigger than Mom and Dad. Get your child to pray about it if you don't have the faith to do it. They believe in Jesus. Jesus says so. That's why it is that children in these vile cities, and some of them come charged all up with Ritalin and who knows what all kinds of drugs, I hear again and again that these children are drugged up and scared and whatever all, but they get in an atmosphere and they want to be with their teacher. They feel peace when they're there. Some children don't even want to get off the bus in Lebanon because they're scared to go back into the television and into the ranting and raving that goes on at home. They want to stay there. And they cry when they have to get off the bus. Why? Because little children believe in Jesus. The little songs that you teach them, they learn them so quickly because they believe in Jesus. Little ones do. But what if I'm offending one of them? What is my life like then? What does Jesus say about that? I know sometimes our family plans, the children might come at a different time and place than we counted on. That can happen. But the Bible says here in plain words, he that receiveth, whoso shall receive one such little child in my name, receiveth me. Did you ever think about it? You took the test and it shows positive. There's a sense in which Jesus is once again coming to visit our house in the form of a little one. And sometimes God calls those little ones home before they're born. Sometimes that happens. It's a sad day, but they're safe in the arms of Jesus regardless. And if we tried to do what we could, God knows our heart. I could say a lot more. The time is racing along. But these passages to me are so precious. So precious. And when the diaper's dirty again and something got messed up out there, one of the tools got lost and the gate was left open and the cow got out and just think about it again, my friends. And I need to do this too. Whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. Is that little one welcome? Is that big one welcome? They know it, if they're welcomed or not. Don't offend them. Verse 10, take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of their Father which is in heaven. So whenever I in anger would punish a child, whenever I would just say some nasty words just to let them know how I feel, God forbid, just anger. If I just deal in impatience and I just can't have this right now, their angels beholding the face of the Father which is in heaven on behalf of this little child. What's the angel telling God whenever that happens? I wish I knew. Whenever one more expectant mom goes to the abortion clinic and the angel that was watching over them for the first days and possibly weeks and even months of conception, what do they tell God as they have cared for this little fetus and suddenly it's thrown into a trash can? I'm telling you, friends, this morning the sin of abortion is terrible. I heard this story, read it myself, of a story of a fetus the size of somebody's thumb. And the doctor threw it into the trash can, and it screamed for I don't know how long until finally it was over. He said that was the end of that doctor's practice in an abortion clinic. The Bible teaches us that if we don't praise God, the stones will cry out, and many fetuses can too. Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of their Father which is in heaven. Verse 14. And you read the interim verses there, this thing about a sheep that goes astray. And that happens. Childhood innocence gives way to accountability. And it's God's will that the building blocks of love and confirmation and whatever happens in a child's life from age zero, age day one until accountability, make the steps so that one more sheep, one more lamb that is one astray can be brought back to the fold. Yeah. It happens to them all. If they're of normal mental capacity, they all go astray. Sometimes they don't come back right away. And they don't all go astray at the same age either. I want that to be clear. I hear sometimes parents fretting over 16 and 17 year olds that have not yet made a decision. I don't necessarily worry about that so much myself if I know this much, that when they sit there in church, they're reverent, they're careful, they're conscientious. I don't care so much at what age they give their heart to Jesus. All I care is that their hearts are soft to the Bible and to the holy things. God can call them in his time. But it's God's will that not one of those little ones perish, regardless of their name, their age, or the family that they live in and where they came from. It's not, God doesn't want one of them to perish. And yet some of them never come back to what they should. With those thoughts in mind, I'd like to read just a few things from a book. I was reading some of this morning. It's close to my heart, and I guess it's just going to be that way. This was a young couple in society that decided they're going to cut short their college careers and dedicate their time to more family. We always thought about having children. Our main fear was for their future. Have you ever feared for their future? Will they live in a world of chaos, unable to enjoy growing up, always in fear for their lives? What will be the survival rate in the future? We recognize that we need to raise children with right morals and attitude, the soldiers of tomorrow. It's up to us to raise our children to be what we want the world to be. My contribution to tomorrow is to teach my son values like the difference between right and wrong. As scary as it is with the world going to hell, at least I can do something for one person. If God's given you five, you can do something for five. And if God's given you 14, you can do something for 14. We are not going to be here forever. We have to pass on what we can, because otherwise it stops here. I learned a lot from my grandfather. He would be upset if all the knowledge and life lessons he shared ended with me. So I feel relieved that I can get to pass it on to another generation. My son can take it on and hopefully pass it on to his children. Then it talks some about the burdens of parenting, and could read some of that. I deal with harsh realities every day. To come home at night and sit there and watch my son sleep, it makes the world okay. Is that true or false? This is a single mom, and you will soon know why she was single. And she raised a daughter, and now the daughter's about 19. My friends keep asking me how I did it. I'm still not sure how to answer. I could say it was tough. I tell you, we ate whenever we had something to eat, and sometimes it was once a day. I could tell you about sharing a mattress in front of a faulty heating element, but my daughter, who is 19 now, will tell a different story. How we laughed till we knocked the heater over, and how we cried on each other's shoulders. Of course, she would like to have had a dad. Of course, I kept praying for him, and he didn't come back. But where would I be without her? I don't think I would have made it alone, and I hate to think of the world without her in it. Our children are valuable. Our youth are valuable. For it, dear friends this morning, dear brothers and sisters, they're valuable. They're worth more than any bank account. You know, a brother recently preaching in our congregation said, most of you people sitting here, he said, if you talk about $100,000, immediately the mind goes, grab here, $1 million. Well, our mind gets bigger yet. Where can we go with $1 million? And he says, and then get one of your children and stand them up front here. And embodied in that person is more than the entire world. Think about it. We are so prone to think of material gain and benefit and advancement. And yet one child is worth more than the entire world. Do you believe it? Jesus said so. I made a brief reference to this the other night. A youth who was trying to make sense out of this wide world we live in. And she wrote some of her feelings that is being expressed from not only herself, but a world of people in our generation that can't understand why life is what it is. She says, "Why do most of you lie when you made the vow, 'Till death do us part'? Why do you fool yourselves into believing that divorce is really better for the children in the long run? Why do you allow us to watch violent movies, but expect us to maintain some type of childlike innocence? Why do you allow us to spend unlimited amounts of time on the internet and still shocked about our knowledge of how to build bombs?" And then this caught my attention, because this is so basic. "Why are you so afraid to tell us no sometimes? Call us what you want to, but you will be surprised how we will fail to fit into your neat little category. Now is the time to reap what you have sown." And our minds can go down the road to that neighbor down there that's nothing but a mess in their house, but how is it going at home where we live? The great disconnect that exists between what we say and what we do. Often the root cause of the divide between our words and our actions is simply laziness. Is that true or false? It's just so amazing to me. Some of the things that come out in the book that I'm looking at here, I just want to read just a little bit more. This was a story about a boy. He had done something bad. And spankings are meant for a good reason. And I encourage that when it's proper and necessary. And he said there's something that happened here that his dad was going to give him a spanking. And somehow, I don't know what the situation was, but he was waiting for the hand to fall, and he just said, "Daddy, Papa, I am really sorry. Do what you have to do, but I know you still love me." To my astonishment, he leaned down, hugged me, and said with tenderness that came from the bottom of his heart, "Christoph, I forgive you." My apology had completely disarmed him, because this incident made me realize how much my father loved me. It has always remained vivid in my mind. It taught me a lesson I have never forgotten, one I drew on in dealing with my own children years later. Don't be afraid to discipline a child. But the moment you feel he is sorry, be sure there is immediate and complete forgiveness on your part. A forgiving hug from mom or dad, especially at times when a child knows he deserves a consequence, can totally change the landscape. As in nature, when the sun breaks through the storm clouds, the knowledge that one's failings have been forgiven is probably the most rewarding experience in childhood. We need to discipline our children the way God says to do it. But make sure that when we've gotten through, there's forgiveness and that they know it. I don't like to use too much personal illustrations, but this one was just on my mind. This morning as I was sitting here, one of the boys was having a real attitude. I guess that's the way they say it in Pennsylvania. I don't know how you say it here, but he was having a real attitude. And it was getting pretty rough. And we needed to work with him for a while. And it was not an easy process. The time of discipline lasted for a while. And finally, the boy surrendered. Finally, the yelling stopped. And he got quiet and still. And I sat down with him for a while. I had him sitting on my knee. I was hugging him. And before long, it was two of us crying instead of one. And I just carried him up after he went to sleep in my arms, and I put him in bed. And I'll tell you, just went over and prayed for a while. And after a while, I just thought, how's the boy doing? And I went over and checked on him. How's he doing? Those are moments that you never forget as a parent. And you don't either forget when that same son gives his heart to the Lord and you have the opportunity to kneel with them and they pour their hearts out and say, "God, I've sinned. I need to get right with you." Those are touching moments in home life. He's got a lot to learn. He's young. If it's any benefit, just take it for what it's worth. When I think about it, it's much easier to live with children who fear you than to live with children who love you. Because if your children fear you, when you come home, they're gone. They scatter. They go to their rooms and shut the door. And you will make it easier for them by piling their room full of computers, sound systems, and everything else. But if you have children who love you, you can't get them out of your hair. They're pulling on your legs. They're pulling on your pants. You come home and they want your attention. You sit down and they're all over your lap. You feel like a walking jungle gym. You also feel loved. Many, many parents are trying to make their children fear them. And sometimes the disciplinary, authoritarian homes produce that. The children, when dad comes home, gone. There's others that the children meet them at the driveway. Can hardly wait till they get out of the car or the vehicle. Moms are that way too sometimes. But our world, the world we live in, is so mixed up. In this book, it tells a story about a man that was having problems with his son and problems with his son, lack of obedience, lack of trust, lack of anything, lack of connection, lack of all, whatever. And he went to a psychiatrist and said, "What should I do for my son?" He had a little interview with the father and had a little interview with the son, and he came back to the dad and he said, "I got a solution for you." He says, this boy here said, does not need more medicine. He doesn't need visits with me as a psychiatrist. What this boy needs is 5 minutes of your time every day." And the dad said, "I'm not giving it to him. I want medicine. I want psychiatrists to deal with this guy." Do you have 5 minutes for one of your children a day? You wonder why the world is what it is, but how is it going at your home tonight, today? I ask that question. I could say more, but I just want to close with a few practical points, very simple points. I've already given the first one, is that we need to have Jesus first. We need to know what new birth is all about. If we're going to work with children, if we're a school teacher, have you been born again? Do you have Jesus' love for little ones and youth? If you're an employer, do you have Jesus' love for those employees? But if you're parents, do you have Jesus' love that comes as a part of the new birth? Another thing is, give flowers in life. A brother in our congregation, right at 2 years ago, laid to rest his 50-year-old wife. And I preached in the funeral sermon, and he cried. I was having a meeting somewhere, and we decided to go together. And that man just bawled and bawled. He says, "Oh, I'm just so sorry about the times when I thought about getting flowers for my wife, and I didn't." He said, "There's nothing I can do about it. When that little one or that older one is lying in the box, give the flowers in life. Don't wait to eulogize till someone dies. It's easy to talk about how good they were after they're gone. But what do they know that you think of them now? If you have a word of blessing to share with anybody here, do it now. Do it today. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know whose funeral you'll be attending before the end of this week. You have no clue. Neither do I. If you love them, won't you show them? Just say so. If you want to encourage them, if they've had a tough day at school, they do sometimes. Get over and say, "Son, how's it going? I see you're a little blue this evening. Could you tell me what's the problem? Daughter, how's it going?" Never correct a child in anger or a youth. Never correct a child or a youth in anger. Never do it, if you can at all help it. I know a man whose son had a very, very serious accident and almost died in the crash. He was in the hospital for I'm not sure how long. And when the accident was over, he had the car towed right out to the front yard of his house. He said, I want my son to learn that you don't drive a car like that. I just want it to be a reminder to him. I could tell you some other stories about that very home. How that mom and dad are with words, not much with actions, but with words. And the boys go downstairs. He said, time and time again, I heard mom and dad at it again. And I'd go down to my bedroom and slam the door shut. And then stuff happens that shouldn't. And temptations are extremely strong. I think some of you know what I mean. Volume in a time of giving a correction does not increase authority. Volume of voice does not increase authority, but it might prove how angry we really are. Volume of voice does not increase authority, but it might prove how really angry we are. In the giving of correction, admonition, and even discipline, don't forget words of forgiveness, appreciation, and encouragement. In giving of correction, admonition, and even discipline, don't forget words of forgiveness, appreciation, and encouragement. Lead not only by words, but also by example. The best way for a man to love his children is to love their mother. Three simple little statements to close with. In our homes, trust needs to be evident. Communication should be easy, and mistakes will be allowed. Let's kneel for prayer.